gentlemen, and welcome to minute 71 of season 8 of Movie Rob Minute, the daily podcast where we foobar our way through the 1998 Steven Spielberg award-winning film Saving Private Ryan, 1 minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me once again this season is Niall McGowan of the Batminute. Welcome back to the show, Niall.
Oh, but I'm happy to be here again, Rob, but podcasting is hell. You know, I wish we were together again under less stressful circumstances.
You find podcasting that stressful?
I mean, it's like the Wild West out here, man. You're just sitting there, you're trying to give your thoughts on, like, oh, Giovanna Ribisi, and all of a sudden a freaking bomb might just blow up right next to you. You don't know what's coming around the corner.
Okay, that's true. That's true. But we'll just have to wait and see how this week plays out from that perspective. So, minute 71 begins with Wade beginning to question his own actions and ends with Upham explaining why what he's doing right now is good for him.
Mm-hmm. See, I was excited when you gave me this group of minutes, though, because it's like, oh, Saving Private Ryan is like so renowned for its action sequences and, like, you know, the battle sequences, and just like, oh yeah, the level of like how innovative and how ingenious and how influential they turned out to be, et cetera, et cetera. And I was like, oh, what group of minutes have I got? I was like, bunch of guys in a church with no lighting sitting around talking.
Well, there is lighting.
Not even just, that. Like, in some minutes, they're not even saying anything. So.
Well, come on. You know, you can't have everything action.
No. As someone who's done a lot of these seasons, you know, including my own show, sometimes you have to break it to the guests. It's like you're gonna get a credits minute sometimes, or you know, sometimes.
Okay, but these aren't credit minutes. And the truth is, I love credit minutes because there's so much to talk about during credits.
That's true. I think some people find the credits quite daunting, but it's just like, oh, you can look into the nitty gritty. It's not just talking about literally what's on the screen.
That's right.
But then, yes, and sometimes the gold are in the quieter moments, like this, you know. Yeah, I remember our first season was just like the guest complained when she just got like the Batmobile going back to the Batcave. And I was like, this is the best part of the whole movie. What are you complaining about this for? Come on. There's loads to talk about.
Hey, well, if it worked, why not?
Yeah. But yeah, because we do open, though, on famed and the beloved character actor Giovanni Ribisi,
which at this point he wasn't yet, because you know, who knew Giovanni Ribisi in 1998?
Yeah, I think it would have been like, I'm sure most people's knowledge of him was as Frank in Friends, like people, you know, Frank Jr. And then over the years, you start piecing together, like, oh, that's that guy from Friends. Oh, there's that guy from Friends again. And then all of a sudden, you start like, oh, this guy's like he's like a guy. And then now it's just like, oh, yeah, famed character actor Giovanni Ribisi. And I barely remember that he's in Friends. It's like, oh, that's right. Yeah, he did that, too. But I'm assuming you've also you might have talked already about he's dipped his toe into being a DP these days.
We have mentioned that, yes.
But, yeah, because it's one of my favorite films of the year, Strange Darling.
Yeah, I haven't seen that yet. I wanted to see it. I've been meaning to see it.
Really, really terrific. Can't tell you anything about it because it's one of
please
those
don't.
Things, like,
please
yeah,
don't.
It's the less you know going in, the better it is. Like, but it's and it looks phenomenal as well. And it was like, oh, you know, who directed it and et cetera, this movie, and then you're just seeing like director of photography Giovanna Ribisi, like. That guy, like the same.
I remember seeing the trailer and being shocked about that. I mean, like I don't know who J.T. Mulder is, you know, the director and writer, but then you see Giovanni Ribisi as the DP, and I'm like, huh, that doesn't make any sense. But you know, the trailer was great though.
It's and the whole movie as well. The fantastic central performances is like Kyle Gallner, who's like again. Becoming one of those guys who are like, oh, that's that guy from Jennifer's Body. Oh, there he's in another thing now. And he's in another thing. And then over the years, you realize, oh, Kyle Gallner apparently is now a guy I have to deal with. and then, yeah, if anyone's ever seen when they did a couple of years back, remember they made Scream into a TV show on MTV? And they had, what do you call it, Willa Fitzgerald was the main, she was like the Sydney in it. And I remember on the show, she was just a real wet blanket, drab, mopey character. And I was like, oh, yeah, this lady. And then seeing her last year in Fall of the House of Usher, I was like, ooh, that's the lady from Scream. Oh, wow, she's really good in this. And then Strange Darling, now I'm like, oh, whatever she does next, I want to be involved in. Like, Willa Fitzgerald is an actress probably like skyrocketing in my expectations now, because she was so good in House of Usher and she's so good in Strange Darling. That's like, oh no, now this has become one of my go-to. Like, I'll start checking her IMDb to see what she's got coming up to make sure I don't miss anything, kind of thing. So,
oh wow. I will definitely be seeking out Strange Darling in the coming days to finally check it out.
Apparently, at one point, Giovanni had an accident on set, and they were all standing around going, tell us what to do. How do we direct the photography, man? Tell us, how do we fix you, man? How do we fix the film?
And then he goes, it's my liver. There's nothing you can do.
Yeah. It's just like, the stock is ruined. We just have to throw out the whole movie. But we're shooting on digital, man. It doesn't make any sense. I told you to throw out the whole movie, damn it.
So what is your background with Saving Private Ryan?
Saving Private Ryan, it was a movie I didn't actually see for a while, which is weird because I was big into movies at the time. But it was, I would have been like 11 when it came out, because it's 98, right?
98.
And I remember all the buzz around it. I remember, it's not like it's a high certificate or anything. It wasn't like an R-rated movie, right? It was.
Of course it is.
It is R, because I thought it had a kind of like, it might have got sort of exceptional circumstances because it was so kind of high caliber and it was so kind of like almost borderline educational. That was just like, oh no, despite the violence, we'll give this, we'll make sure more people can see this. Than
you can have something that's borderline educational, but it's still, if it's as gory as this movie is,
I think maybe because it had such an Oscar prestige as well. You kind of think like, oh yeah, Oscar movies don't tend to be like, riddled with people walking around with their severed arms and stuff.
That's right.
Like, well, this one does. But that's potentially why I didn't see it for a while then, because I would have been 11. I just remember a lot of buzz about it. And then I don't remember there being an emphasis on it being like, over here it would be like an 18 certificate. It was more like, oh no, everyone can see this. But then I guess for whatever reason I didn't. But then the first time I did see it was in school. During secondary school or high school, one of our history classes. And I think it has that kind of reputation of being like, this is one of the most, brutal and realistic and sort of, no romance, no sweeping, whatever. That's a very simple plot line. It's kind of partially based on, true story, et cetera, right. Et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
That it was deemed worthy enough by my secondary school history teacher to be like, we're going to put on a Saving Private Ryan because people should see this, because it's kind of as accurate as you're going to get at that time rendition of what being in a World War II battle was like,
So, right.
Sure. Yeah, the first time I saw it was in school, and then I think that it hits TV soon after that. It was one of the big, in Ireland, you always have an RT one, used to, on a Wednesday, they would have the big film premiere. And that was like it was always a big deal to see what they had on that week. And then I remember, I think it was like a run of something like Rushmore. And then you're like, wow. And then the next week is like Saving Private Ryan. It's like, wow, those are two very different movies,
very
but different. Also weirdly similar in their own ways because of the end of Rushmore. It's like, oh, I guess Max Fisher made his own Saving Private Ryan, actually. So, but yeah, and from that then too, it just like over the years, It's just got such a reputation that it's like, oh, you just sort of, it'll always be on television, it'll always put it on. There wasn't many occasions that I would ever sit down and watch it from start to finish, because it was just always on TV, so it'd always catch snippets of it here and there. But for the first time in a long time, sat down and watched it start and finish for this very show.
You were welcome.
I have to tell you, stands up. So it's still a really good movies.
Understandable. So in the UK it was rated 15.
Fifteen. So,
right.
Actually 11. I probably would have gone away with seeing that, I imagine, as well. But I think probably. But I think now though, looking at it, the only thing is that I've become so much more heightened in awareness towards Spielberg's tendency for smaltz. which is very minimal in this. But when it peeks through, it's very like, oh, you can't help yourself, guy. Yeah, man. Like, there's a little, and maybe it's not so much smolty, but like, I don't know, the moments where, the minutes you've covered already, where like, you know, the mother's finding out about the other Private Ryans, the Privates Ryan. You know, and then there's that bit of her going to the door and then collapsing and the soldiers standing there and stuff. And that's all very like, it's, I mean, it's not to say that wouldn't happen, like, that's not a realistic interpretation, but it has a very, that has a much more of a kind of film, movie, sweeping sort of a grand film romantic gesture kind of way of portraying the grand tragedy and stuff. And sort of done that sort of over, Spielberg and over egg thing sometimes. And just that moment, this time, I was very like, oh, I don't know if I would have done it that way, because it's very, I don't know. It's trying to play in the heartstrings too much, whereas the rest of the movie is so just, like, brutal, and so just, like, it's not sentimental, and it's not, like, it's really just, like, no, we're here to just, you know, to get through the harsh, bitter realities of all this so much. This time I did find that scene, but I'm like, oh, that would have been a thing I would have done differently if I were him.
Okay. Well, you're not him then.
I think you know, it happened since, like, I remember watching The Fablemans last year, and then there's that the opening scene of like Michelle Williams saying to baby Steven Spielberg, like, but you know, movies are like magic, darling, and then like, oh God, Steven, no, don't do this. And I've been so thankful that the rest of the film wasn't like that either.
Right.
Like, he just got it out of his system in that opening scene. And then he had this little, like, heel-clicking bit at the end. And I was like, well, whatever. But,
right.
I don't know why. Maybe as I get older in life myself, I've become more embittered. So I'm just like, oh, any level of smolts the guy brings out, I'm like, dude, don't. Just don't do this. Like, just steer away from all that.
Right.
But yeah. The fact that you don't get any of that in these minutes, though. Get a little bit of humor, to be fair, but it's done in a very, very human and a very, you know, just realistic guys, you know,
right,
shooting the shit in a way. So
that's right. And finally having a little bit of downtime and, you know, letting their emotions catch up with them also.
Yeah. Very much so.
That's right. So we ended last week, you know, in the church, and we continue the conversation today, where basically Wade isn't really sure why he was keeping himself quiet regarding everything with his mother, you know, when she would come home and whatever. I mean, it tells us a lot about his character, the way that he did it, because he just opens this minute with, I don't know why I did that. You know, like when, because a lot of times, you know, you look back in life and you wonder, okay, why did I do something in particular? And you don't necessarily have an actual answer as to why you did it. You know, at the time, I guess it felt right, and that's why you did it at that point. But then when you look at it years later, you're like, well, was that the right decision? I don't know. I couldn't even explain at this point why I did that then. You know, that type of thing. And so I like the way that they present that, with the two of them, you know, talking about this, you know, with all the guys talking about this whole thing like this. And then Miller, like, walks over towards them. I guess Mike went to sleep. Who knows? And Miller still, I guess, wanted to talk. And he walks over to the men and whispers, we only got a couple of hours. Shut up, go to sleep. But he says it in a nice way. Yeah. It's not like yelling at them. It's not like, shut up and go to sleep. It's, maybe you should shut up and go to sleep. That type of thing.
Yeah.
And like, he just looks around.
He's doing it in a, he's doing it in a classic authoritarian Tom Hanks way.
Yes.
Where it's like, sometimes Tom Hanks has to be a tough guy.
That's right.
He's still Tom Hanks.
That's right. You know? And you're still going to listen to him, you know, especially with these type of perspectives and stuff like that. And then Oppum,
you know, in the green, you like that, he didn't get to where he was in the Green Mile by being like a nice guy all the time.
That's
at
true.
The same time, you can still go out and hang out with Tom Hanks afterwards. You know, or what's his name? That Paul, the guy.
That's right. Paul Edgecombe. Paul Edgecombe.
He's still your buddy.
That's right.
Yeah, Paul Edgecombe. Yeah.
Hey, come on. If you're gonna be the main guy on the mile, you know, you gotta know what you're doing. You gotta be stern.
Yeah, that was a book I had because I'm a big Stephen King guy. I had to abandon that book a few chapters in. because the film is so much of a literal perfect translation, I couldn't not picture Tom Hanks in it the whole time. So it was really like, I like to create my own version of these things in my head. And then this was just like, no, they nailed that with everything. And you couldn't cast anyone else but Tom Hanks. So it's just like,
yeah, well, that's because, Frank Darabont, at least at that time, that's what he was best at. I mean, look at Shawshank, you could say the exact same thing about. You know, it's not worth reading the book, the novellas, the novella anymore, because the movie is just so perfect and expands on so many little points, but, you know, it just gives you almost a perfect movie or a perfect story with the way that he does it.
Yeah, you got the little thing though of like, oh, the fact though that in the novella, like Red is like, oh, he's a white Irish guy, like, you know, with red hair. That's why he's called Red. So you can imagine someone else, but Morgan.
No, but they I love the way in the movie they just take that exact same line and just make it a joke.
Yeah. But the thing is, when you're reading the book though, you can be like, oh, so I can picture another actor in doing this now because they presented me with these circumstances. But then anytime it goes to Andy Dufresne, you're like, no, that's Tim Robbins. Like that's who you get to play that part, because he was probably, and John Coffey is like, who else in the universe could play that part? It's like, no, they found the one guy who could do it. Like Clark Duncan, that's it. That's the only person who could ever have done that part. So because of that, and then, but you know, we'll be getting into Tom Hanks' performances down the line though, because he is always somewhat, many ways he's kind of limited as an actor. Not in a bad way, like, you know, though that does sound very insulting to say that to an actor, that he's quite limited. But every time he's cast in a role, it's usually because, well, that's, they needed a Tom Hanks. And no one does it better than him. You know?
Yeah, that's very true. That's very true. So at this point, Upham then asks the question. He goes, Captain, sir. He goes, Corporal. He goes, how you doing there? Are you all right? And he goes, yeah, I think this is all good for me, sir. Really? How is that? So, I mean, it's great the way that Upham is trying to, like, break a little bit of the distance between him and Miller here, and, you know, trying to to find some common ground between the two of them. So it's done well, the way that they have this, because Upham is also a very, I guess, I don't know if simple is the right word, but he's a very innocent type of character at this point. At least.
Yes.
And, you know,
it's got that thing when you become, you know, more media literate, everything about Upham at the beginning is just like, oh, you poor man, you're going to go through so much stuff because you start off as such a naive innocent. It's like, you ain't going to end this film
that's
the
right.
same way. You know, if you make that's it out of this at all, you're not going to be the same man.
And I mean, the conversation between them also, it sheds more light on Miller, because Miller, like, sits down next to him. He's, you know, he's somewhat of a father figure here in this perspective, you know, talking to him, you know, caring, I guess, about the fact that he's all right, and that if he is right or if he's not all right and things like that. And, you know, he seems very curious to understand why Upham seems to think that everything is good right now. And then Upham starts a quote and says, war educates the senses, calls into action, and then he gets it cut off. So, you know, we'll talk more about that entire quote tomorrow when we get the rest of it.
Yeah. Again, I was like, got the minutes. I was just like, okay, which brutal battle scene do I get to cover? Oh, I'm doing the Ralph Waldo Emerson section. I was like, oh, god damn it, man.
Well, come on. When I thought of somebody who would be perfect for Emerson, I said, it's got to be Niall. You know?
I do scream Emerson, that's right. Like, constantly. Whenever people see me, they're like, that's a guy who reads Emerson right there. It's like, the only Waldo I know is the guy in the book. and not the guy you have to find, not the guy who's trying to find himself.
That's
Ralph Waldo.
But we'll get more into that tomorrow with that whole thing. Yeah. Again, as we both stated earlier, there isn't much to talk about in this minute because it's just a small little simple conversation between the two of them. But it tells us so much about the characters, you know, about what it is that they're seeking and what they're looking for here. So I like the way that they do it. And at this point, even though Upham just gives only part of the quote. We also can see that Upham is showing how educated he is at this point. Is he showing off or yes. not? We'll have to dive more into that tomorrow when we get the rest of the quote and the rest of the conversation between them. But yeah.
There's one I have to say as well that, like, again, because it's been a while since I've watched this in its entirety, and completely have forgot that Jeremy Davies was in it, even though it's such a prominent part. I have to say, like, that guy is, like, people scoff at the whole Clark Kent, putting on some glasses and people not recognizing that he's Superman. And I believe it now because I do not recognize that man without his mullet. Like, Jeremy Davies is so synonymous now with that mullet he had in Justified. And there's so many other things. And his mullet and his little beard that when he showed up, I was just like, I know that guy from somewhere. And I'm like, holy shit, that's Jeremy Davis. And oh my God, I didn't even recognize him. But there you go. You will believe a guy can.
Well, again, that was one of the points of this movie, to take all of these young unknown actors who somehow have become much more famous over the years. The question will always remain, were they bound for fame regardless, or did this movie push them towards that?
Yeah. It's weird. It's like, it's literally everybody in this movie is just like, there's a random private. It's that guy. Like, there's not one person in it who's not recognizable. You're like, oh, that guy running around there. That's Paul Giamatti. That's right. You're like, Paul Giamatti was in this? Yes, he was. Yeah. It's like, you imagine so many of them must be going. They bump into each other at parties and been like, I was in Saving Private. I was in Saving Private Ryan too. Who did you play? A random private, But it'll be like, all the, not even all A-listers. It runs the spectrum though. It goes from the Matt Damons down through to the Jeremy Davies, who's like, yeah, he's famous. He's a famous character actor.
He might not be an A-lister, but he had a very steady career afterwards.
Oh, yeah. We can talk about him more throughout the week because I love Jeremy Davies as an actor. I think he's always a really great, reliable screen presence, but always playing characters who aren't really like this either, too. So it's kind of weird because he's so synonymous to me with being like scumbag hillbillies and stuff. He has that. That's the character he's become. Then to see he kind of got his start essentially. He was in things before this, but this was his first.
Right. Major I actually loved him in Lost. I think he was great in that role there.
Yeah. I think he's terrific in everything. It's just as soon as he shows up, he was like, oh, Beyond the Floor in safe hands now. But for him to be playing like a kind of a well-educated, quiet, docile, nervous character when I'm used to seeing him, usually always playing kind of sniveling, like untrustworthy, slimy, horrible, horrible people. but he's he excels at both.
I guess that shows how good of an actor he can be. He can play both those kind of roles.
Yeah,
totally. That's what's important. All right, excellent. So do you have anything else you want to say about this minute before we move into today's segment?
Not in this minute in particular. Anything that we said more about this minute will be relevant still in the
that's true.
The next minute.
That's very true.
It's all we're with these guys for a while now.
Okay, so every Monday we have a segment called Maestro Monday, where my guests will give their top five John Williams movie scores, themes, however you want to look at that. So why don't you once again start with your number five and work your way up?
Number five, I'll go. So I always try to go a little bit off the beaten track with some of these things. I'm going to go in with The Long Goodbye. It is Robert Altman's The Long Goodbye. John Williams did the score for way, way back before he was John Williams. And it's a really ingenious. Yes. Have you seen The Long Goodbye? And you're aware, throughout the whole thing, it's a Marlowe story. It's Elliot Gould. Schlubbing his way around, amazing movie. So much of the basis for you can see the poker face and stuff. So much of Tarantino, so much of Paul Thomas Anderson could be all taken from The Long Goodbye. And but throughout though, there's a recurring because there's the opening theme which actually has a sung segment too, where it's The Long Goodbye. But throughout, I remember noticing when I first watched it, I was like, oh, it's really ingenious that, like, the same leitmotif from the theme pops up everywhere and in various forms throughout. So, you know, you'll have the kind of the low-key jazz version is the main theme, and then you'll get a really dramatic version of it playing later on. And then Marlowe will go to, like, a Calypso club. And in the background, you'll just hear, like, played on steel drums and stuff. It's like, that's the same damn thing. And then at one point, Elliot Gould's going around looking for his cat, because he's looking for his cat the whole freaking time, basically. And he starts muttering to himself, going, like, oh, I hate the cats. It's like, he's singing the theme as well. Jesus, does everybody know this album? How much permanence does this goddamn song have? Yeah, I love that. I thought that was really, really ingenious. The fact that and one of the lines in the chorus though is, "Do you recognize the theme?" I'm like, "Are they taking the piss?" Like, of course I recognize the theme. It's everywhere. But yeah, great movie, great sound, like, and very like not. It's kind of a sign of things to come with John Williams, to be fair, because it's very different from what he's normally would go on to do. But he is the king of the leitmotif. Like, you see him, and a lot of modern composers now aren't as heavily reliant on character themes and stuff. So you get, like, you know, Hans Zimmer is very just, like, wall of sound, general, like, it's all good, but there's no, like, that's a certain character's leitmotif coming back. But John Williams is all leitmotifs. Like, the guy, he loves to get a good hook into a character. And for so much of my life, because he was so synonymous with things, I just thought that's the way that all composing worked. So, like, if you don't have a leitmotif, then what do you have? But then I'll go on. I just have to say, I always feel, you know, someone this big and this big successful, you want to like shine a light on his lesser known stuff, but then all his best stuff is exactly best stuff. So like number four then would be like, well, E.T., you know, E.T. is this phenomenal soundtrack. It's got one of those things, there's certain notes in the E.T. soundtrack, hearing them out of context will still get a drastic emotional reaction out of me. Where it'll just do a couple of, you know, a couple of bits of the, you know, the build up to the bike taking off. If you hear that anywhere, you could be the worst day of your life and hear it playing on a friggin' subway. And as soon as you hear those notes, it'll still get a little pang of like, oh, yeah, that bit from E.T. Like, it's just, you know, he's really, really powerful score. Like, that's such a powerful emotional film. And that score adds so much to it. Perfect marriage of, like, you know, filmmaker and, you know, composer and everything in that thing, really. But we'll be talking more about E.T. later in the week as well, and how good it is. And also, too, I just have to, because Williams is like, he's so talented, but he's such a dark horse as well, because the opening scenes of E.T. to me are terrifying. Like, all the aliens are shifting around the woods. And, you know, the opening credits is just like, it's all black and then purple writing, and it's all just ominous sounds. It's
all you didn't see it in the theater when ambient, you were eight. So yes, it was scary.
Well, yeah, imagine they, I remember when I was a kid, I had to skip to like a half hour in. I couldn't watch the start. Because I love spooky stuff now, I'm like, that's like some of the best horror music. One of the best creepy openings that any film ever is the beginning of E.T. where it's genuinely like so unsettling for so long. And you're like, what an odd choice to make as well, to be like, yes, we really want to win families over with this whimsical alien. Let's begin with 20 minutes of you've been scared to by him because you don't know what the hell's going on. And it's just all, it's just really ominous. Like that organ music, that that's really unsettling as well. It's like, they had a concept. And him and Spielberg were very on the same page. It's just, why did you go for that page? Now I'm like, oh, I love it. You know, don't go for a different page, but it's just an odd choice. And then you get into, you know, some of the big ones, like number three would be Raiders of the Lost Ark. I was torn because I was initially going to put down Temple of Doom because I love some of the sections in that, you know, like. I used to play that a lot when I was a teenager. That used to be always blaring. So I was like, oh, I'll go, because Temple of Doom has all the Indiana Jones themes, but then that as well. So I was going to just put that down. But then I was just like, nah, that map room theme from Raiders is, like, exceptional. Like, that's a proper, like, absolute masterpiece of work. This, that whole sequence in the film is great, but the actual score in isolation of, you know, this, of course, you know, the sequence Indy going in and putting this stick in and the sun hitting it, and just the way that builds and builds and builds, and just, you know, the real, the quarrel, like, da, da, da. It's just like, it's so majestic, and it's so like, just, it's just fantastic. Like, it's really, you know, it's one of those days that you wonder when, you know, sometimes you, like, a composer goes away and makes a bit of a score and then has to come back to, like, the director or whatever and present, like, here's what I've made. And there's certain ones you just wonder, like, what was Spielberg's reaction to hearing that? Just been like, yeah, here you go. So this is the music for that sequence. And how could you not be like, holy shit, that's some of the best music I've ever heard in my life. Like, you made that for this scene? That's incredible. You know? So yeah, but just because of the map room music, I'll put Raiders ahead of Temple of Doom just a little bit. And then number two, very relevant this week because it's popped back up in the pop cultural lexicon time of recording. Superman theme, and just that whole soundtrack is again immense. I always feel a bit weird though because I think the best rendition of both the Krypton theme, you know, that and the main Superman kind of march, it's all great in the 78 movie. I think the rendition of it that was adapted by John Ottman for Superman Returns actually better. I think it's weird because, like, maybe it's because I saw, maybe I've got like a weird bit of nostalgia tied in because, like, you know, Superman Returns isn't a good movie overall, really. It's a bit of a slump, you know. It's, you know, it's not the worst thing in the world, but it's too long and it's too dry and it's too, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, at the time, in my lifetime at that point, there hadn't been a Superman movie out. Like, you know, the last one was Quest for Peace. It was the year I was born. So by the time then, you'd grown up in the Richard Donner movies and then getting into the theater and then hearing the Krypton theme kick in and then, you know, getting this is all the build up, you know, the way the theme goes, builds a big crescendo, and then you finally get, you know, picking up the shield. And in the cinema, I was just like, this is incredible. Look, what a move. What a masterpiece we must be in for now. Look at how good these credits are. And because of that, I always feel that, like, Ottoman, I think because maybe he has the benefit of hindsight. So, you know, it's like, I know these little parts of the theme really work. So if you build up to that a little bit more, it'll pack more of a punch. So before he goes into the, you know, the, he actually leaves it like a little stanza longer. And it kind of, because you're anticipating it coming, and then he leads you a little bit more, so you're like, and there you go. And it's a delayed gratification with it and stuff. And he knows to kind of put in recurring motifs in the background that Williams doesn't. So you'll just hear layered in the other parts from elsewhere in the score will be layered in. So I think automatically, you know, he didn't come up with it, but he had the power of hindsight to be able to go, I can take this ingenious score and give it a bit more, not a bit more oomph, because how much more
oomph do you need
for a Superman theme? But he's like, I can polish this a little bit more to be like, hey, here's an even more pristine version of it. But you wouldn't get that without the original Williams score. And again, that's just like such a, you know, that opening sequence though of just like, oh, how do you start your Superman movie? It's like, well, here's Krypton. Oh, how do we get people into Krypton? Like, why don't you just introduce this Krypton theme? This is one of the most beautiful pieces of music you're ever gonna hear in your life. it's just literally shots of the planet. And then, you know, you're sitting for like a minute and a half, and after that's done, you're like, oh man, I feel like I've been through something already here. Like, it was that was so good. But yeah, so that'll be number two. I'm not too sure, like, you know, not to date the show or anything, but if James Gunn is outright going to just use the John Williams score in his Superman, in many ways, I hope he doesn't, because it's like,
yeah, but that, score, but man. That, like, is
the Superman. Say what you want, but the Snyder movie.
That's the problem. You know. No, but in the trailer, you know, for anyone who's seen the trailer that we're talking about, you know, it's done very, it's done in a very subtle way.
Yeah, yeah, it's very much. I think the use it in the trailer is more of a mission statement to be like, because we've been through the more somber series, you know, Snyder Superman. I think he's trying to go like,
right,
I'm tapping into this specifically, that old school Superman that you remember from way back when. But to be fair, like, you know, say what you want about the Snyder movies, that Hans Zimmer Man of Steel soundtrack's freaking phenomenal. So if it's like, oh, you just if you could still give us a brand new Superman score that's as good as the other two,
correct?
Yeah, I mean, that'd be pretty sweet, you know, because. As much as I love the Danny Elfman Batman theme, Michael Giacchino came up with a freaking amazing soundtrack on his own that had nothing to do with it. So it's like, yeah, just do that again, you know? But then, and then number one, very specifically for me, is The Empire Strikes Back. Is out of all the Star Wars scores, I think that's way, way the best one. Most of it is because it introduces The Imperial March, which I think is John Williams' best piece of music. Really, like, when I was a kid, I obviously had Empire Strikes Back on VHS, and the part I would play the most was just the end credits, because it has, I think on the soundtrack, it's called, like, The Rebel Fleet, and then just, you know, end credits, or whatever. But all the section from, like, Luke getting his hand fixed, up through, you know, them staying at the window, and then into, because you get everything. You get, you know, the Leia theme, you get a bit of Yoda, you get, you know, all the main Star Wars stuff. So you're getting all your big hits. And then, like, I think they've messed around with it too since the Disney Plus release. They've thrown in some random crap, and they're like, no, it's, it was perfect. This is the, but like, well, we got more credits we had to add in now because we've messed around with it so much. So we had to add in more music, but. One of the phenomenal transition throughout those end credits where it's going through the Han and Leia theme, and it kind of starts slowing down, and you know, and it kind of builds up to this sort of slightly more tragic version of it, and like and then it just goes and it goes into the Imperial March. And every time I hear that, I'm like, oh my God, that's so good. Like, that's just, oh, what a master of his craft. And then just, yeah, you get the full tilt of the unadulterated Imperial March, which is, you know, but my favorite pieces of music of all time. Because I love a villain. I love a good bombastic score. And this is like, yeah, the, you know, the finest moments in Star Wars to me are in the early stages of Empire Strikes Back, when they destroyed the probe droid, and then it's just like, it's that guy from that one episode of Fawlty Towers going like, you know, oh, we better start the evacuation. Waldorf solid guy. And then just the cutting to the first time you ever hear the Imperial March is just, you know, the Star Destroyers, and dun, 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 and then it's the shadow going over it, and then presenting the Super Star Destroyer, and then cutting to Vader just looking out as the first time you see him since A New Hope, and you just get that thing of like, oh, well, so they're f***ed then. Now this guy's back in the game. There's no way he's going to mess around. So, yeah. And then just the score again adds so much to that. Yeah, absolutely terrific. You know, it's one of those things people say nowadays, John Williams is like, well, he's not, you know.
Well, how old is he?
The effort as much anymore. He's not coming out with all these clowns. He's that old. And two, after a while, it's just like, by 1990, he could have gone, you know, like, I'm done. Like, what do you want from me? Like, I've done so much for you people already. And then after that, it's like, oh yeah, here's a Jurassic Park score as well. That's going to be a masterpiece, like a minor masterpiece I'm throwing out to you at the same time. But yeah, there's some of those guys, like Danny Elfman's the same. Danny Elfman's gone off the boil in recent years. But then you're like, yeah, but consider that output from like Oingo Boingo up through like 1994, where everything was a masterpiece. You're like, Danny Elfman and John Williams could have retired before the turn of the millennium, and they would have had just unblemished, you know, they should be living off that music they made back then for the rest of their lives, because they earned it. It was that good. But yeah, so it was good to actually have the force to make the score, because I just, in my head, it was always a bit of a mishmash. I'm like, well, they're all good. And now it was just like, oh, I have to actually put down which one is the best. And then discovering to myself, I was like, because I would have thought like, oh, maybe Raiders would have come ahead of Superman, or maybe JFK would have come in there somewhere. But then to go down to, it's like, no, if I actually think about it, this is the list. So, but I'm sure you've answered already.
I haven't answered because I answer on the front
of what do you think is
you'll have to tune in 100, almost 100 episodes from now to find out.
Yeah. You're going to go in there and be like, you know what? It was Hook the whole time. Like, what?
Don't give it away. Don't give it away.
But yeah.
All right. Excellent. Thank you very much for that list. So, Niall, would you like to tell everyone where they can find Non McGowan?
Yeah, you got me. My kind of main thing is Bat Minute, which is a show wherein we cover the Batman movies minute by minute. We've done quite a few seasons now. Did all the original 89 through Batman and Robin and the live action movies. Then we did a little mini season on, it was a full season. It was just the film was way shorter. 70 minutes of Mask of the Phantasm, because it's a very short little movie. And then last year we did a mini season where we did Batman Beyond Return of the Joker in chunk form, which is a bit of a different way of doing things for us, where we did it 5 minutes at a time. Still had a lot of fun. A lot of stuff to talk about in Batman Beyond. So we got to really delve into an area of the DCU that's not explored all that much, and talk about Terry McGinnis and co. So that's just out there fresh for everyone, for your listening purposes. And then coming up next year, which I'm very excited about, because we went deep into the future for Batman Beyond, but now we're going to the way back, to the long, long ago, returning to the minute-by-minute format to cover 1966's Batman the Movie, starring one Adam West, as our next season, which is just so much.
Make sure you have your shark repellent.
Oh, yeah. Oh, baby. It's going to be, there might actually be blood is going to get drawn between guests to see who gets that minute. it's the most, if you ever say to people, oh, what minutes do you want? It's always the shark repellent. That's what everyone wants to talk about. there can only be one, or well, maybe two. But
especially with that, with the rubber shark.
Oh, God. So people forget too, when the shark falls into the water, it blows up. The capper to that scene, that the shark freaking blows up at the end. And that's in the first 10 minutes. It's the very start of the movie. It's a whole other thing about the terrible trio or whatever have decided to turn the UN into sand and stuff. It's
that's right.
It's insane. But yeah, so much to talk about. Gonna go into all the Adam West, Frank Gorshin of it all, the Cesar Romero, we'll be looking into not just because Lee Merriweather in the movie, but when we get into all the Catwoman casting controversies and it's gonna be. I'm really, really looking forward to it. It's gonna be a bit of a change of pace for us, because usually we're into particularly the last few seasons have been very dark, somber Batman, and now we're going swinging vastly, drastically in the other direction. So we'll be, and we're trying to get everybody in that we can to talk about. So obviously, Rob, you're welcome on. The don't call the shark repellent now, though, because it's gone.
You know me, I'll do anything now.
I'm going to try to find minutes of Batman and Robin quietly talking in a church for 5 minutes.
I was going to say, if they're talking about Emerson, then you got me.
Thing is, though, Adam West Batman would be the type of guy who would talk about Ralph Emerson as well.
That is true.
Him and Robin would really get into it. But well, dear chum, that is a quote from one of our most esteemed essayists, Ralph Waldo Emerson. but we'll get there. We'll get there.
Yeah, I can actually see him saying that.
Oh, 100%. Definitely. Definitely, yeah.
Big
old. Yeah. All right. Darn it, Batman. I thought it was Walt Whitman. No, the folly of youth, dear chum.
All right. And finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Around Minute. You can find me on Facebook. You can find me on Twitter. You can find me on Instagram. You can find me on my website, movieroundminute.com. And if you want to send me an email, you can send it to movieroundminute@movierob.net. So until tomorrow, Ernest.
Ernest.